Okay, we're marching ahead of our schedule, which is great because we have a long, full day planned ahead. Next up, we're going to have a panel discussing the new developments in commercial cargo and crew. I'm going to introduce our moderator, who will introduce the rest of the panel. Our moderator is Pam Underwood of the Commercial Space Transportation Office. She's an aerospace engineer with the Office of Commercial Space Transportation at Kennedy Space Center, Florida. Pamela Underwood, in her role, is responsible for facilitating the Partnership for Commercial Human Spaceflight with the NASA Commercial Crew Program. Previous to her current assignment, she worked for AST, that's our abbreviation, from their field office at Patrick Air Force Base in Florida. Her responsibilities included facilitating the Partnership for Launch Safety and representing AST to the Common Standards Working Group with NASA and the United States Air Force. She earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Aerospace Engineering from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University and a Master of Science degree in Aerospace Engineering from Virginia Tech. Before joining AST, Pam worked as an integration engineer supporting the solid rocket booster element on the Space Shuttle program at Kennedy Space Center and as a wind tunnel test engineer at the National Transonic Facility at NASA Langley Research Center. Please welcome Pam.
Everyone in the room is thinking, I thought I got a break now. Well, let me just tell you, we're not taking a break. We're going to go ahead and move into the panel. We're moving a little bit early, so why don't I go ahead and invite my panel members to come on up. And while they do, it was great to see General Bolton again. I will tell you a little story. The last time I saw him, I was probably this much pregnant with my son. I was sitting in this on his commander's advisory board for one of the launches, and it took on a new meaning when he would look over and say, is the FAA okay? Because he was really talking about, didn't know if he had to factor an additional different kind of emergency into that kind of a launch, but everything was fun, so it's good to see him and have him involved again. Well, thank you to my panelists for being flexible on time. I just kind of shot them an email and said, hey guys, I hope you're ready to go, because it looks like we're going to start a little bit early. So we have the distinct pleasure today of talking about the new developments in the commercial crew and cargo arena. This year especially has been a very exciting year for everyone on this panel, and we're fortunate today we get to hear some of their insight and experiences. It'll be good for to also have you be able to ask any questions you have about things that they have run into and their accomplishments made to date. So without any further ado, I'll go ahead and introduce as we go along. We've got Phil McAllister. Phil is the director of the commercial spaceflight at NASA headquarters, where he oversees the management of NASA's commercial crew and cargo programs. Prior to this assignment, he was in NASA's Office of Program Analysis and Evaluation, where he served as the executive director for the review of U.S. Human Spaceflight Plans Committee, also known as the Augustine Committee. Prior to NASA, he was the director of Futron Space and Telecommunications Division, where he managed a group of 20 analysts involved in space industry analysis, market research, and technology assessments. Over his career, he has been involved in commercial vehicles, the redesign of the International Space Station, and the advancement of several commercial space ventures. Phil has an MBA degree from Everett University, an MS in Systems Engineering from George Mason University, and a BS in Physical Sciences from the University of Maryland. Thank you, Phil, for being here with us today. Our next panelist is Chris Ferguson. Chris is the director of the crew and mission operations in the Boeing Commercial Crew Program. In that position, he's responsible for oversight of crew interface in the design of Boeing's commercial crew transportation system. He also plays a key role in the development and testing of systems, concepts, and key technologies for the commercial space transportation CTS-100 spacecraft and integrated launch and ground systems. Chris is a retired Navy captain and a veteran of 3 shuttle missions. He has logged more than 40 days in space and 5,700 hours in high-performance aircraft. And he was the deputy chief of NASA's astronaut office. Thank you for joining us today, Chris. Our next panelist is Adam Harris. Adam is the vice president of government sales at Space Exploration Technologies and is responsible for implementing and overseeing SpaceX interactions with federal agencies. Prior to joining SpaceX, Adam was most recently served as the staff director of the House Select Intelligence Oversight Panel on the Appropriations Committee. His other experiences include senior advisor in the Office of the Director of the National Intelligence and as an officer for 8 years in the United States Air Force, with assignments at Cape Canaveral and Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and the National Reconnaissance Office. Adam received his Bachelor of Science in Astronautical Air Engineering from the United States Air Force Academy and a Master of Science in Aeronautical Engineering from the Air Force Institute of Technology. Thank you for joining us today, Adam. Our next panelist is Bill Claybaugh. Bill is the Senior Director of Human Space Systems at Orbital Sciences Corporation. He was formerly the Director of Studies and Analysis, Office of the Program Analysis and Evaluation, and the Director, Reusable Launch Vehicle Program Office at NASA. He has also served as the Director of NASA's Office of Exploration. He holds a Master's of Business Administration in Finance and Strategic Planning from Yale University. Thank you for joining us, Bill. And our final panelist is Mark Sarangelo. Mark is the Corporate Vice President for Sierra Nevada Corporation Space Systems, a producer of satellites, space transportation vehicles, propulsion systems, and space subsystems. Mark was formerly the chairman and CEO of SpaceDev, Inc. before its merger with Sierra Nevada. Mark is the chairman of Emeritus of the Commercial Spaceflight Federation and the founding chairman of eSpace, the Center for Space Entrepreneurship. Thank you, Mark. As I mentioned, we have quite a few panelists today. I'm done talking because I'm sure we'd love to hear some of the things they have accomplished this year. And Phil, we'd like to go ahead and start with yours. Did you get a chance to get your slides over? We're just going to hear Phil talk.
How's this?
Okay, great. So no slides. I'm taking a page from General Bolton's book and not going to bore you with PowerPoint slides. I'd like to say I did that for you guys, but primarily it was for me. If I have slides, I have to coordinate that with 15 different offices at NASA. It's a real pain. They change happy to glad, glad to happy, and by the time it's done, it probably won't reflect what I wanted to say in the first place, so I can just talk now. Clearly, there's something wrong with that system where I can just say whatever I want. So 2014, wow, it's only 5 weeks old, and there's been some amazing accomplishments from my end of where I work already. Like most government employees, I had a lot of leave at the end of the year, so I took a good portion of December off, came back to NASA headquarters, forgot which floor I was on when I hit the elevator. I was like, am I on 7 or 6? It had been so long since I'd been there. And man, we hit the ground running. Within the first week, we had the announcement to extend the life of the International Space Station to 2024. It was an amazing announcement from my standpoint. I wasn't expecting it. That's certainly not that soon. And it was really significant for the Commercial Crew program because if you think about it, now, as of now, we've never had a better business case for that market. When we first announced Commercial Crew, if you remember back in 2010, we were looking at probably about 4.5 years of operations for the International Space Station. Now, today, if things work out according to schedule, we could have as many as 7 years of operation. Business case has never been so good because of that decision to extend ISS lifetime. So that was fairly significant. Just a few days later, the Cygnus berthed with the International Space Station successfully. That marked the fifth time that we have resupplied the International Space Station with domestic capability since the retirement of the shuttle. Twice under the COTS program and then 3 times under the CRS mission. So just another great accomplishment to continue with that program, the Commercial Cargo program. And then just a couple days after that, we got an omnibus appropriations bill, which I really was not expecting. I'm trying to figure out which one I wasn't expecting more. It's hard to say. I have always been sort of very optimistic about the budget, and then the reality sets in. This year, after sequestration and after the shutdown, I can honestly say I was not very optimistic. We got $696 million for Commercial Crew. While that wasn't as much as the president's budget request, it was more than we've ever received. It was actually an increase. And also, the difference between what we requested and what we got had never been so small. So that was significant from that standpoint as well. So after just 5 weeks, I kind of want the year to end so that we can just claim those accomplishments and wrap up. But we still have a lot to go for the Commercial Crew program. within the current agreements, the CCICAP agreements, there's significant milestones that we have to meet, development milestones to continue to mature those designs. We've got some critical design reviews. We have some safety reviews that are all very important. And we have some tests. We have some abort tests planned for this calendar year, as well as another free flight test of the Dream Chaser. So some significant development activities and milestones scheduled to occur in 2014. And so we're looking forward to those. Also, we're going to make awards for the next round of commercial crew late this summer. That's going to take us all the way through development, and it includes some initial services missions. So that's going to be huge. And if, for those of you who have been tracking commercial crew carefully, we preceded that with a small contract, phase one of that contract, to sort of help with the dialogue between us and our partners to ensure that their designs were going to ultimately meet NASA's requirements. We're engaged in that activity right now. We went through round one, and we're in the process of going through round two to close in those designs with our requirements, and that's going to be another key activity in calendar year 2014. So I guess the one thought I want to leave you with is, when I think about commercial crew, we are relentlessly pursuing the next human spaceflight from U.S. soil. That's the adjective that I keep thinking in my head. We are relentlessly moving forward. We're going to hit some roadblocks. We're going to hit some hiccups. Not everything's going to work perfectly, but we are determined to continue to relentlessly pursue that goal, and that's what we're going to be pursuing in 2014. Thank you. Wasn't that good?
Thanks, Phil. I appreciate that. We'll move on with Chris. During this time, you know, if you guys have questions, I don't know if we're still doing the card piece. The microphones are in the center as well. But, you know, try to hold your questions till the end of their presentations, and we'll have a good discussion at the end, if that's all right. Chris, go ahead.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm not quite so brave. I think I have a few charts sitting in there someplace. Maybe you could bring those up. And while we're doing that, hey, Pam, I would like to thank you and the FAA for all of your support. It's been wonderful working with you in particular, Mike Mitchell down in Houston. You know, of course, the Boeing entrant into this not only, of course, launches and is subject to the launch licensing rules, but we also intend to re-enter over land and perform a land landing. So we'll be working with you on both sides of our mission. Phil, and I would like to also thank you and NASA. I'll tell you, being able to get ISS out to 2024 is just an amazing thing. You know, it seems like it's a long way away, but some of these long-term planning evolutions we have to go through, it's just wonderful to be able to look out there. And of course, you know, crew up to ISS is the foundation of what commercial crew is all about. So knowing that we can plan out for that additional 4 years really just solidifies the business case.
Well, Chris, you're welcome. You know, I did that all myself. No help from anybody else, so no problem.
Absolutely. All right. Well, let's go through. Again, we'll try to keep this as brief as possible, full of pictures and all those fun kind of things, and I actually get to advance my own slides. This is wonderful. Look at that. Hey, this is the Boeing Get on the Stage. We've been in this business for an awful long time. You know, the Boeing heritage companies, Rockwell, McDonnell Douglas, have been in human spaceflight for 50 years. Does that make us the perfect choice? You know, maybe not, but it certainly makes us the one with a lot of time in doing this. Of course, we're the prime contract on the International Space Station. We have a really good presence there in the Houston area. So it's just great to be a part of a company with this rich history, not only in commercial aviation, but also in space. I'll walk you very quickly through where we are. Far off to the left there, you see the vehicle that we will launch on. It's an Atlas V. Of course, that's an X-37 launch. The ULA carries a 4 and a 5-meter fairing. There, I believe you see the 5-meter fairing. One of the interesting aspects of our entrant is we won't have a fairing. So we have the aerodynamics associated with, you know, being one of the payloads that launch without a fairing on the Atlas V. I believe that Mark and his team are planning the same type of operation. We'll have to modify Launch Complex 41, the existing Atlas V launch facility, slightly to provide the ability for the crew to get in the vehicle out on the launch pad. So to this, in the second picture from the left there, you see a rendering of the crew access tower. It'll have an access arm that swings over the vehicle, not much unlike we saw with the shuttle and with the Apollo. The ULA is the prime contractor to build this facility, and they are the beyond PDR portion of the design, and we've seen some excellent plans, and they are on track to build this structure for us. Of course, the Atlas V, 43 successes. I hope I have my math right, but not too. I guess it was last week we launched another Tedris with a 100% success ratio. So again, proven rocket, significantly reduces system risk. And then our integration with our ULA launch partner is well underway. Of course, it'll be work. This is an interesting sort of a change for a crew aboard a vehicle. Formerly in the shuttle and the Apollo architecture, the entire launch process and post-launch with the mission control was through one entity, NASA. Now, to get the vehicle off the ground, we'll be working with ULA. And then once the vehicle is airborne, you see over on the far right, we'll be working with our mission operations organization. And we have actually gone back to NASA and their 50 years of expertise in human spaceflight. And we'll be working with the mission operations director who we have brought on board to perform our mission operations for us. In the center, you see a rendition of our spacecraft. We'll get into a few more details shortly, but let me go down to the orbiter, or the ground processing operation. This is, for those of you who may recognize it, OPF, or Orbiter Processing Facility Number 3. We now call it the C3PF. We wanted to keep the 3 in there. But far off to the right is the old engine shop where the space shuttle's main engines were processed. I was in there just last weekend. It's been completely gutted, and it's going to be refurbished to manufacture our service modules, the bottom portion of the spacecraft. And then off the left in the old orbiter processing building, respectively, will be where we would process and construct our crew module, the reentry portion. Just a quick look at the vehicle. It can accommodate up to 7, but you see on the far left there for the NASA mission, we're going to install 5 seats, 4 to satisfy the NASA requirements, and then the 5th seat can be used either for cargo or perhaps for a passenger. And of course, there's a lot of negotiating between us and the space station program as to what the best use of that extra seat would be. We have a clamshell design to our spacecraft. There's essentially no welds in the upper and lower dome, so it's a spun form. It's a very interesting manufacturing technique, which enables us to essentially break the sections in half if we ever needed to get anything larger than the hatch opening through the hatch. We don't anticipate doing this, but it is an enhancement that that's a part of our design. You see a rendition of the cargo layout, as well as Glacier. Glacier is one of the payloads, the power payloads that we're obligated to carry, as well as the double mid-deck lockers and how we stow our payload. In the lower left, just some of the big parts. The ascent cover will be jettisoned shortly after staging in the second stage to reduce some weight and also expose our cameras so we can record some of the imagery. The forward heat shield covers the parachutes. That will be retained for the entire mission until reentry, and then it'll be jettisoned at a higher altitude to enable us to deploy the parachutes. We have thrusters in both the crew module and the service module, and we finally got an opportunity in our simulator to be able to fly using our actual jet logic and a model of the actual jets, what our vehicle will fly like in space. We've had a few NASA astronauts over to take a look at our simulation. I think they're pretty happy with what they see so far. And then over on the right-hand side, you do see we have some a small solar array, and that is to meet NASA has a requirement for a 77-hour duration. We're largely a battery-powered spacecraft, but we have the ability to recharge those batteries during insulation, and we'll use tail sun and pointing in that array to charge us up. Just a real quick overview of our mission. Of course, in the lower left, we launch from pad 41. We spend up to 210 days on station, and then return deorbit to a land landing in a few sites that I'll get to shortly. As Phil had alluded, we're in a multi-stage development right now. We're in the third of actually 4 stages. This is a Space Act Agreement stage, so we're paid by the milestone. And you can see we're getting just near the end right there. This phase will be over midsummer. We just finished, as I had mentioned, the pilot and the loop demo, which was an opportunity to actually get an opportunity to see what our vehicle flies like in space. Just walk you through some of the highlights here. We're in the process of a suit selection, so we have a couple suit vendors on board. We'll make a selection with those probably within a couple months or so. We do have an engineering sim that's up and running in Houston. We don't intend to be a water landing, but we do have a requirement to land in the water, so we've done some development tests to ensure that our vehicle behaves properly if it does land in the water. In the middle, off to the left, a lot of aerodynamic work going on, both coupled with the Atlas V and then in free flight for reentry. And let's see, a good panoramic view in the center on the bottom right there. Some of you may have seen, we had a sort of an open house in July, and we had a lot of media interest, which is really encouraging to see how interested the general public is. I think there's a general feeling of we want our space back and we want to know what it's all about, so we gave them a little snapshot view of what we were doing. Again, just some photos. We've done a lot of our RCS, our reaction control system jet testing, and we've qualified those. They've been repurposed from a prior program. Launch abort engines. We have a pusher abort system, which will enable the crew module to be propelled off the front of the rocket for all of powered flight. And we've repurposed a Bantam engine for that purpose, and we've done a series of tests. And of course, we're a parachute recovery, and parachute development test is very very high on our list as well. And then in the lower right, since we are a land landing, we're looking for ideal landing sites out there. I may have mentioned this last year when I was here, but if you have a good 16-mile square area of flat space and an old dry lake bed you're not using, we'd love to hear from you. But we have a few we have selected, and here they are. Some are not that unfamiliar. Edwards Air Force Base, Wismer, White Sands Missile Range, of course, the space program is very familiar with those. We consider those really alternates, however. Our prime will be up in Dugway at Yuma and at a dry lake called Wilcox in Wilcox, Arizona. So, and we're going to stage our recovery force centrally so we don't have to have a permanent presence at any of these locations, and we'll roll out from a Boeing facility currently located in Mesa, Arizona. You know, I included this only because, you know, landing is an interesting thing. And Orion, some of you may remember, started with an airbag design. We adopted the airbag design from Orion, and we're running with it. One of our recent additions is a center airbag. One of the interesting technical challenges we faced was when we landed in water, there was a water geyser effect that would come up between the center airbags, and it would actually create a structural issue with the base of the pressure shell. So we added a center airbag that deploys for water landing, but it won't deploy for a normal land landing, and we've got a lot of extensive testing done with that. And then finally, just to wrap up, you know, we talk about landing site development. This is what we're looking for, and we think we found it a couple good areas. We're working with the current owners of those areas. Some of them are fairly remote, so they present a few logistics challenges and how to get out and service that vehicle or once it's on the ground. But this is what the fun is all about. So I think that's all I had. Thanks.
Thank you, Chris. Adam?
Yeah. Let's see if my slides were... Well, thank you very much for having me here today, and appreciate the FAA sponsoring, and very much want to thank NASA for a couple things. One, for getting the commercial crew budget through the omnibus. I know that was not all NASA, but it was a lot of work from a lot of people, and it's good to have some stability in the budget there. And then second, congratulate NASA for extending the ISS. I think that will be really great for everybody in this industry. It will allow a business case to go forward. And SpaceX is really excited to participate both in the crew program and also the cargo program with our Falcon launch vehicle and Dragon spacecraft. As many of you know, SpaceX founded in 2002, and here in 2014, we're just over 3,500 employees. We have most of our manufacturing operations in Hawthorne, California, and we've done recent launches from Vandenberg and launches from Cape Canaveral, and thanks again to NASA, we will be launching a crew here from Kennedy again from Launch Complex 39A, which is the former shuttle pad. We're really looking forward to getting that pad and working with NASA to return crew launches here to the United States and doing that from U.S. soil. Recently, so our holiday was quite busy at SpaceX. In September, we had the launch of Cassiope from Vandenberg, a low Earth orbit launch. And then we followed that in December with SES from Cape Canaveral, a GTO launch, and then in January with a TICOM launch. So we were extremely busy over the last few months getting these launches off and making sure our customers were 100% satisfied, and each of those spacecraft are doing great. We're very pleased with that progress, and we're looking forward to our next launch, which will be a cargo resupply mission for NASA here coming up in March. The COTS program, of course, just a little history here. SpaceX participated in the COTS program, Commercial Orbital Transportation System program. A great innovative development at NASA, firm fixed price, milestone-based agreements. SpaceX completed two orbital test flights under that agreement. We became the first private spacecraft to berth with the International Space Station. Could not have done that without NASA's partnership. Could not have done all of those operations without the partnership with NASA and the help of NASA. And so we want to continue that. We're continuing that with the Cargo Resupply Services Program. We've had two of those flights, and we have further flights coming up here scheduled in 2014. The Falcon 9 upgrades for the last three flights improve the upmass of the ability to take additional cargo to space station. It also increases our ability with the Dragon. We're adding power to the cargo capability, and so we're looking to innovate and improve wherever we can and get additional scientific value out of that, out of the International Space Station. We believe we're the most affordable cargo transportation by far to the space station. And again, the cargo resupply was a firm fixed price, milestone-based contract, and we're looking forward to what comes beyond 2016. The current contracts run through 2016, and so with the extension of ISS to 2024, we're very much looking forward to continuing U.S. Capability and commercial capability to supplying cargo to the International Space Station. On the crew program, SpaceX is working this year on the CCICAP. I'm sorry, I'm not supposed to use any acronyms, but the Commercial Crew Integrated Capability Contract, CCICAP, is ongoing and currently ongoing. And SpaceX's goal is to make the Dragon and Falcon system the safest crewed spacecraft in history, quite frankly. We are currently developing a integrated launch abort system and evolving the Dragon spacecraft that is used for cargo to be able to accommodate crew. We have two major milestones that are upcoming this year that are test milestones. Those two milestones, the first one will be an abort test from the pad. So if you're not moving at all, can you get the spacecraft away from a rocket? And so the first will be a pad abort test, and we'll be doing that later this year. And the second test will be an in-flight abort. And so my Falcon 9 guys are a little upset at me that I'm going to reuse a perfectly good rocket. I'm going to take it up to max Q, which is the max dynamic pressure that is on a rocket, and I'm going to abort. And so I'm going to make sure the Dragon spacecraft can safely move astronauts away at the worst case possible events, and make sure that everything is safe, reliable, and the best that it can be. SpaceX has a further goal of reusing both the Dragon spacecraft and launch vehicles, and so we will continue to innovate and make sure we can do that with many of our programs, and hope to obviate the need to send taxpayer money to Russia to launch astronauts and bring that back to U.S. soil and launch from Kennedy Space Center again. As many of the companies up here, we are on January 22nd, we submitted proposals for the next round of commercial crew, and we're awaiting NASA's decision there, and whatever I can do to suck up to NASA, I will do it now. At this point, let me play a video. That may be a separate file.
Capture complete. Looks like we've tamed the Dragon. We're happy she's on board with us.
And launch of the
SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket. Flying up in a human-rated Dragon is not going to be an issue.
To close, let me just say thanks again to NASA for the partnership we have enjoyed through the COTS and CRS programs, the cargo programs, and the very grateful for the partnership for the crew program. But I also want to thank the FAA. We at SpaceX are pushing the boundaries of launch and reentry, and that includes both launch vehicles and spacecraft, and we couldn't do it without the partnership of the FAA and the licensing that we get from them, and working both launch events and for reentry events. So I wanted to say thank you for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam. Our next presentation will be from Bill Klaboff from Orbital.
Well, that was quick. I too want to thank Pam for the effort she put into pulling this panel together, and Phil, of course, for the work his office has done in pulling together a series of remarkable programs, which are changing the way space travel is done. So let's see if we can get this to work. Orbital developed entirely on its own funding the Antares rocket. There's a cartoon here. A couple of missions have flown. The last of those in green is currently berthed to the space station. We'll be undocking on the 18th, pending our customer telling us to stay, but currently planned for the 18th. We're going to try and do a video now real quick, if we can do. This is just a very quick overview of the initial COTS mission. We unfortunately did not get a video together for the current Orb 1 mission yet. Pair of Antares cores in the horizontal integration facility. Here you see cargo being loaded onto the Cygnus, putting it away for launch, moving it to the shell.
Antares beginning the journey of the G. David Lowe Cygnus cargo vehicle to the International Space Station.
The vehicle goes straight up for about 30 seconds, so you get a nice view of the coastline as it descends. Stage staging. You see one of the springs that separates the two stages in the foreground. That's the fairing coming off of the spacecraft. Second stage burned. Looking forward at the spacecraft, separating from the second stage, and then the second stage skews so as to avoid contacting the spacecraft. an image taken from ISS as the vehicle approached. Screenshots that the crew sees as the vehicle approaches, confirming that it's in the right place. It's looking from the spacecraft at No. 2. Team apparently was pleased by that. So the vehicle is now being maneuvered into berthing position. I should mention that Sierra Nevada, Mark sitting next to me on the left, makes the part that actually berths with the ISS for us. Is opening the hatch, beginning to pull the cargo out.
And release confirmed at 6:31 a.m. Central Time as these two vehicles were high above the Atlantic Ocean, just east of Argentina. Again, Cygnus has been released by the crew of Expedition 37.
David Lowe was an executive at Orbital, a good friend of mine, and we named this spacecraft in his honor. Okay, if we can get back to the more boring part. So, a very quick update on where we are. This is getting ready for the current mission. That's the Orb 1 first stage and second stage integrated on the left side of the image, part of the fairing. Here you see the Orb 1 stage moved over to the right side. It's on the transporter to go out to the pad. The other first stage is for the next mission, Orb 2, scheduled for May 1st. That's the Orb 2 second stage, sitting in the black composite object in the foreground. And getting ready to close her up. Going out to the pad. So, minor point, the IIP of this vehicle is such that for typical missions to ISS, we just barely cross the easternmost point of Brazil. Otherwise, the entire mission is over water. So we launched on January 9th. We launched on the first second of a five-minute launch window. Berthed on the 12th. Hatch opening on the 12th. Most of the cargo was, in fact, unloaded that day. Unberthing is currently scheduled for the 18th of February, but that is up to our customer, and if they want us to stay to wait for more disposal cargo, we will do. Currently planning on a series of exercises over the next day and then a entry into the Southern Pacific Ocean at a targeted point to destroy the vehicle. So, most of you know, Cygnus comes in two parts, a payload cargo carrier and a extremely capable orbital transfer vehicle, which we call the service module. Here we're loading cargo for the current mission. Service module on the left-hand side and the integrated service module and cargo carrier. Buttoning up the hatch. We carried 1,465 kilos on this mission, including, among other things, a series of 33 CubeSats, which are being launched today, I believe. So this is on approach, just getting ready to grapple. Have just grappled. And then berth to the station, hatch open. That's the full cargo load before it begins to be put into the closet. And this mission was named in honor of C. Gordon Fullerton, who, in addition to being an extraordinarily gifted pilot, test pilot, and astronaut, also flew the B-52 that Orbital used for the early Pegasus missions and is a longtime friend of the company. So Orb 2 missions currently scheduled for the 1st of May. That is on schedule. We currently, this says 1,650. Just yesterday we were told it's actually going to be 1,633 kilos. That one's on track. Orb 3 set for October. That is actually ahead of schedule at this point. Orb 4 will be in January next year. We have manifests through 16. Obviously, there are additional missions through 2024, given the extension of the ISS. We are already buying long lead hardware that is required for those additional missions, and that is being done at our risk. There are other missions for Cygnus. The service module, as I said, is an extremely capable orbital transfer vehicle. It is completely capable of autonomous rendezvous and docking. We see numerous other low-orbit missions for that capability. So the bottom line is, we're up and running, taking cargo to the ISS. Yes.
Our next panel speaker is Mark Sarangelo.
Hi, good afternoon. Oh, come on, guys. This is space. You can smile. So I'm going to, for the next few minutes, see if I can make you smile a bit when we talk about space, because it's really an amazing time for us all to be up here. And while there's been lots of thank yous, I think one of mine is that, George, I remember when I first did this in the first year, we could have done it at the lunch table together. So it's you and your team get an amazing amount of credit for keeping this alive as long as we've been trying to keep our programs alive. And now we have so many more people here and so much more interest, and a large part of it is due to your help in getting this working. So thank you all from all of us for your efforts and Pam's efforts to make this go on. So welcome, and most things in our business start with people, and I'd like to acknowledge I have a couple of my team members in the room. John Olson is somewhere here, and Cassie Lee is here. And I'd like you all to turn to Cassie. She's in the middle here. She just got married. Congratulations, Cassie. You see, I get to embarrass people when I have the microphone, so it's a good thing. And as Bill said, we were very proud to be part of Cygnus. This is my personal favorite view of Cygnus, but it has something to do with the fact that we built this device. But a lot of what we do is in partnership, and I think we have some extraordinary partnerships here. And actually, my company is working with all three of the companies here represented today. You know, we connect the future to the past a lot, and I talk about this a lot in my speeches, that we are no better than the people who have come before us who've made this happen. And particularly in our case with Dream Chaser, we are highly reliant on the 135 shuttle flights and much of the work that's gone on. 40 years worth of work has made me a lot smarter person as I've gone into this program. So for those of you out for NASA in the room, thank you for allowing us even to get to this place, because we're learning and taking all those lessons that you guys have used and making it work. There are a lot of advantages to our program. I think we represent a much updated version of what the shuttle is. We're a very low G landing vehicle. We're coming in at less than 2 G's. We have no toxic fuel on the vehicle. We land on a runway, any runway, really any commercial runway. George, don't worry, I'm not going to be landing at National tomorrow, so you don't have to you don't have to deal with that. But we could, and that's sort of the fun part about this. Wouldn't that be good for one of our future meetings here? It's a very highly maneuverable vehicle. We don't have a separate abort system. It's actually embedded in the vehicle, so we're able to use our motors to fly around in space and do a lot of missions. And I like to call our vehicle really an SUV for space. It has multiple missions. Beyond the NASA crew and cargo missions, it can do a lot of other things, and we're very proud of that fact. And it's significantly reusable. For those of you who don't know, Shuttle Discovery got 39 missions, and as complex and as big and as difficult a vehicle as the shuttle sometimes was, it had an extraordinary career. And we're expecting to see that kind of reusability. And in our view, we really try to divide work up into three main areas: working in space, discovering space, and exploring and observing from space. And the idea of having a utility vehicle that's really only focused on low Earth orbit, that has the ability to do many of these things from the same platform. We've taken pages out of the commercial airline industry and other industries to say that you build a standard frame and you customize it for different purposes and different activities, and we're really pretty thrilled about doing that. So I'm going to buy a drink for anybody who knows this. I've been doing a lot of announcements lately, and I have a special announcement that's going to guarantee that we're going to get all the business from NASA that we need. Does anyone know what this special space device is? Close. It's the world's first 3D chocolate printer. And I'm carrying it on board my spacecraft with me, so it will guarantee that we have a happy crew all the way through. And it's an amazing invention, isn't it? You think about being able to build chocolate in 3D from a device that can go inside a Dream Chaser. Come on, guys. It's not that serious. Have a little fun. If I could maybe show this video, and what this video shows instead of me talking is a updated history of how we've built the vehicle over the last 2 years, and then I'll talk about where we're going in the future here shortly. One of the core aspects of the vehicle is that it is an all-composite design. And for those of you who have worked with composites, one of the huge benefits out of it is, while there's some weight savings and certainly strength savings, it's the ability to build a lot more vehicles once you've built the first one. That really is a key part of this. And driving the cost down of future vehicles is an amazing thing. What you're seeing here is the full motion simulator for the Dream Chaser that is now in operation, and the first atmospheric vehicle that we built. The easiest way to think of this is our Enterprise. It was designed to fly a couple of times to do the atmospheric tests that we needed to do, and then give way to an orbital series of vehicles. We're using our own hybrid rocket motors for the abort system and the main propulsion system of the vehicle. We've done various amounts of scale drop tests, and this one was done with the University of Colorado, and could have never seen happier smiling college students than the ones who got to drop that day. We've done a series of air tests. This one was over Boulder, Colorado and the surrounding areas, and we've got about 400 UFO calls that day. I'm wondering why we were flying, who was invading Denver that particular day. We brought the vehicle out to the Neil Armstrong Center with the Dryden Flight Center, and carried a series of tests on the ground and in the air while we were out there to test out all its operations, and then did several captive carries tests that probably one of the more traumatic things you can do with your space vehicle that you've been building for 9 years is to dangle it from a helicopter and hope that somebody doesn't hit the wrong button. But all that went really well, and we then did our first free flight tests, and now we're in the middle of a whole series of actual flight tests, and the flight results from this test were nearly perfect, and I'm actually going to share those with you here in a second. So what you're seeing here is, I just wanted to share a little bit of the flight test results that we've gotten. These are actual pictures imposed over Google Earth Maps. The white line is the flight line that would have been a straight line in. We dropped the vehicle in the green box, which was the drop box, and we intentionally dropped it off center line. And the autonomous software pulled the vehicle in and flew virtually a perfect approach and landing. And this is a fully autonomous flight. There was no ground operations. The entire vehicle was controlled on board by the flight computers and the flight software. This is a different view from a side look of that same flight. And when my team first came, brought this in to show me, I was on at the test site, but we were looking at this data, and I thought they were just joking with me, and they sometimes do that. But the idea here is that blue over white in this particular instance is a pretty good thing. And it was about as perfect a flight as we could have wanted. The vehicle's now been, as you know, we had a landing gear failure on one of our landing gears when we landed. That was one of the only things we didn't actually do in-house. We borrowed it from the Air Force, F-5 airplane, and one of the landing gear didn't deploy, but thankfully the vehicle was built so strong that it really didn't sustain much damage. This is actually the vehicle coming back out of NASA and driving back across the desert. Second trauma in the world of someone who runs a space company, you put your space vehicle on the back of a truck and you drive it across the Rocky Mountains in the wintertime and waiting for the particular phone call that something went wrong. But it is transportable, and I think that's one of the fun things about this vehicle, and one of the good things is that we are able to move it around. When we're done flying, we can move it inside a cargo plane. It doesn't require any special handling. So this is supposed to make you smile a little bit for those of you who watch the Super Bowl. Do you ever really want to break out? And I put this here because we tend to have a little bit of humor. And it wasn't that long ago where we were on the outside of the fence looking in. And we're now digging our way underneath and starting a whole bunch of new kinds of partnerships and relationships. And sometimes they're a little odd. And those relationships can really move us forward, though, in many ways. I'm very fortunate to have a terrific team of internal people, but really America's space team and now the world space team behind us. We have over 15 industrial companies, 8 NASA centers working with us, multiple universities, and some of you know we announced the expansion of our relationships into Europe with bringing on ESA, DLR, and OHB, and we're expecting to continue to add to that list. And the reason we're doing this is because, from my point of view, while we think we're pretty smart people, there are a lot of smart people in the world, and we think that being collective is the best way to make space happen as safe and as soon as possible. And my role internally with our team is that if we can't see ourselves being the expert in this area, we're going to find it, and we're going to bring it on board, and we're going to partner in the right way. That means in the U.S. we now have employment in 30 states on this program. And that's growing, and that's a pretty good thing. We think that having a national footprint and having people involved in America's space program in places that you wouldn't normally think of space states. We have people in New Jersey who have a fondness for what we're doing, and it's really amazing to go see our picture of our vehicle up in places that aren't normally thought of as space states. So space is really a team sport in our view, and sometimes you can be small and you can lead a pack of horses down the road, and it's a really good thing for us to be able to do that. Last week, we're fortunate enough to now announce our first orbital launch. We've now confirmed the acquisition of an Atlas V, and we have a launch slot and a launch date for November 16, and that's really exciting to take something from concept to see it fly and now to have the launch set up for it. We're very pleased about that. And we have our little rocket compared to the real one in the back. But the being there is part of the TDRS launch. We were actually on the TDRS team as well, on the Atlas team. We really are contemplating now what it's going to be like to go into orbital service. And that's not too far away. In a couple of years when we do this event, we'll be talking about our launch date happening that year. And that launch team is made up of people from all over the country, but it's primarily on the Atlas side, driven from Colorado, Alabama, and Florida. And we really appreciate that cross-state kind of activity. Beyond the current program, we are now in construction on our orbital vehicle. That is moving forward and being done in partnership with one of our strategic partners, Lockheed Martin, at the Michoud facility in Louisiana, yet another state that we've brought on board. We're using the existing composite structures and facility in Michoud to help us out. We have just recently announced the intention to work towards using the ONC operations and checkout facility in Florida to do this work. This is where Orion will be doing its processing, and we're going to be able to, hopefully, when we sign our move forward with our agreements there, is to utilize that facility, and then come back and land on the shuttle landing facility. And Those of you who've not seen it, it's a pretty historic place to be, and a lot of America's space history has landed there. Including our little vehicle had the chance to have an experience, and I put this up here because it was one of the fun parts of what we were doing. Is that I am fortunate enough to have a terrific team of people, but one of them is Steve Lindsay, who was the former head of the astronaut office and has flown 5 shuttle missions. And we got to bring Steve out to the SLF. And the way our world works sometimes is sort of humorous. He had not seen the plaque that was done for his final landing on the SLF. And so we took him out there and put Dream Chaser out with him. So, Phil, I wanted to thank you personally for something, if I could. Thank you for shutting down the government last year for 3 or 4 weeks. It was a really useful thing for all of us.
You're welcome. You got all myself also.
You did. Phil is an amazing guy. But one of the aspects of that was sort of fun, we all live in a world that has a lot of connections in our world. Because of the government shutdown, we actually did our flight a little bit later than we were anticipating, and we also learned that the gates of Dryden get locked in a government shutdown. We didn't quite know that either. My spaceship was on the other side of the gates when we were there. But in a world of coincidences, we actually did our first flight at the same moment, at the same time, in the same place as Enterprise's last flight was done as a result of the shuttle. So we always thought that was cool, and we went back and found the picture flying in the same location, coming in and approaching the landing strips in Dryden. And what I will say is we have better cameras these days after all these years. So it's a really good thing. So thank you for listening. I hope that was interesting for you all, and we look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you to the rest of our panelists. I'll open the floor for any questions you guys might have for our group. I think there's a mic up here. All right. Well, you guys are diving to the mic. Oh, you do have a question. I'm sorry. That's you just running the restroom.
2 questions for Phil. One, no thank you on this one. Actually, just wondering, Congress gave you a little bit of strings attached with part of the money for commercial crew this year. And I guess I'm wondering how arduous it's going to be to clear that hurdle and free that money. And do you anticipate being able to free the additional resources prior to making a determination on contract award? Second question would be, I know that we got a 2024 extension of ISS, but of course the engineering analysis was that it could go to 2028. Any idea why that wasn't pushed a little further, which might have helped the business case a little bit?
Right, so the second part of that question, no, I have no idea why. Wasn't part of any of those discussions and was surprised as everybody else just when I heard the 2024 announcement. So really no insight into that. I'm sorry. In terms of the benefit cost analysis, we are actively working that. There's a lot of variables as far as how long it's going to take, so I can't really say. We hope to be able to clear that hurdle and satisfy that congressional language and get those funds released as soon as possible. I really can't give you a schedule other than we're working on it actively and hope to get it done as soon as possible.
Great. Thank you. Other questions? That was a question. All right, let me get us started. With the significant progress and activities that all of you have completed this year in your various companies and organizations, what are the lessons learned that you're going to carry forward that really you think might shape your future going forward? And Adam, why don't we start with you?
Sure. I think the biggest lesson from this past year is that testing and orbital experience is the best arbiter. At some point, you got to tell the engineers to put the pencils down and stop doing the analysis, and you got to go out and test and make sure your products and your space vehicles work in the real environment.
Absolutely. And Mark, any additional comments?
I think my first one would be make sure you tow your vehicle outside the gates in a government shutdown. That's actually a pretty serious comment. Us and Lockheed and a number of other folks found ourselves in a unique position. I think the main thing is really for us is that we're seeing the benefit of building cross-state, cross-country partnerships. And while that's been being built for a while, we're starting to really see the benefit of how we can accelerate our program. And from our perspective, we're ahead of schedule, and that's because of the great partnerships we have. And the advice is it takes time to do that, and it takes years sometimes to build those up, but now we're really seeing the benefit of how that works.
Great. And Bill, same question?
I,
I don't know that I have any specific, you know, dramatic lesson learned, other than the lifetime lesson that this is an extraordinarily hard business, and making it look easy is very, very difficult.
Chris?
Yeah, sure. So we talked a little bit about testing. Adam mentioned that. You know, the way that the funding profile for the first three phases of this acquisition are, we get paid by the milestone. So we don't get sort of a large lump of money that we can use at our discretion. So we have to be very judicious about what we do and when we do it, and we better be right. You know, look at AeroData, for example. You know, fortunately, we got an early jump start on some of the Aero work that we had done. So anytime these things come up, it really, you know, it's a big discriminator for companies to be able to see a problem, realize a challenge, and then have time to fix it, you know, before you have to report out on the next phase. So that, I think the lesson really there is, you know, an interesting funding profile and making the wise choices to test what you test and when you test it, and you better be right or you'll find yourself behind the eight ball.
Good insight. And Phil, I'm going to put a little bit different spin on it just for you. So with COTS, that was a big success, big completion for COTS program for this calendar, this last calendar year. What are the lessons learned that you see that NASA's carrying forward into their other commercial space programs?
So there's a lot of lessons that you can take away from the COTS program. We did a lot of things differently, and it's hard to isolate exactly, you know, which ones significantly contributed to success, which ones were sort of marginal. We've thought a lot about that and which ones we would take forward. I would say that one of the lessons in terms of future programs is you have to match the approach for the program. The COTS mission was very unique, and I think that dictated a unique approach. It doesn't mean that approach applies for every mission. Sometimes a more traditional mission or approach is more appropriate. So you really have to tailor your approach to the mission. And hopefully we will have additional opportunities to apply the approach that we did in COTS. It was, I think the biggest lesson, I don't know about lesson, but sort of takeaway is that if we wanted to do something differently, we now have a successful model on how to do that. Instead, in COTS, we were very much making it up as we were going along. Didn't know what was going to be successful. We were actually able to learn as we went and incorporated some as we were going forward. But that was that's the biggest thing that I think in terms of the success of the program. You don't have to create it from scratch. You've got a model that you can go to. It doesn't mean you have to follow that model exactly. Great example is Commercial Crew. We took the lessons from COTS and used that to conceptualize the program, but we've made some adjustments because the crew mission is unique from the cargo mission. So, and I don't mean to ramble on and on, but also a good thing is to have the flexibility to do those different approaches. And I think that's been a very positive thing. We've seen a variety of insight-oversight approaches, a variety of clauses with respect to intellectual property, a lot of cost-sharing differences, and being able to have the full trade space at our disposal is very beneficial for NASA.
And one follow-up to that, do you think that those lessons learned that you just described, do you think that will influence any NASA as an agency to use or potentially commercial use in the future?
You know, I frequently get a similar question, which is, what does NASA think about X? And I really, you know, you have to remember, NASA's a big place, a lot of people in it, and there's a lot of opinions. It's very rare that NASA thinks one thing about anything. So I'm very careful about saying what NASA thinks about these sorts of things. But clearly a lot of people in and outside of NASA notice the COTS program, notice the success, and hopefully we'll be able to adopt those sorts of practices in the future when appropriate.
That's great. Thank you, Phil. And any other questions from the audience? Because I have another question. Don't jump for the mic all at once. Okay, so moving on. Each of you have been very successful in your experiences for technology and operations and support to NASA Commercial Crew and Cargo throughout this year. Are there things that you think should change that would help you and your organizations be more successful? Mark, why don't we start with you this time?
Well, clearly the answer is we need to shut down the government more often, right? That's my lesson
learned.
I
agree, Phil.
I'm working at it.
When do you need that vacation to go pick up your daughters?
Yeah.
I was going to say put the FAA in charge, but I guess that would be.
I did not pay him to say that.
I think probably the thing that is out there, in all seriousness, that I would like to address, because I think it affects all of us, is that this idea that somehow, because we as industrial companies are leading the bill, that these programs aren't going to be as safe as any program has been in the past, or safer. I just think that idea is just, in our view, ludicrous. We have put in a huge amount of effort to ensure that the safety is the number one priority. And despite whatever criteria there may be on future competitions, that doesn't matter. We're in business to safely deliver people back and forth to space. We have people on my team who live that world in NASA. We have dozens and dozens of people whose job it was to do that. And we have as our number one priority to be able to do that as safely and directly as possible. And in doing that, I think one of the big lessons learned is to embrace governmental agencies like NASA and like the FAA, because it is in understanding what those needs are going to be in the future that we can design our vehicle to be better today. And we're taking that step very proactively. And delivery, I think, by all the companies here of certification products this year, ours was 10,000 pages worth of safety and certification data. It's a very, very serious effort. And it is probably the thing that we will spend most of our time and energy on going forward.
Great. Thank you. We're running a little short on time, even though we started early. Chris, do you have any thoughts on that question also?
Yeah, sure do. What can we as an industry do? Getting stationed to 2024 is a long way. I mean, that, like I said, it's what's really fostering this tremendous competition that we have going. But 2024 is just 10 years away, and in the large scheme of things, that's not very long. What are we going to do after that? We really need to maintain this toehold that we have in low Earth orbit, or the whole business case breaks down for getting there safely and inexpensively. So we need to look beyond 2024. Will we extend station to 2028? What will the commercial world do? You know, is there a market out there for perhaps, commercial low Earth orbit stations? I'd like to think we'll end there someday, but, you know, perhaps that's where the next phase goes for NASA. I'm not really sure what they have on their plate, but it's always to create the destination. We have to have a destination in low Earth orbit, or we'll struggle to keep the business model running.
Great. And Adam, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah. I think here in Washington, D.C., we tend to have a lot of budget debates, of course, and I think one of the biggest lessons learned is we should all push for stable commercial crew funding in the future here. Unfortunately, in this town, a lot of times the budget debates are a zero-sum game between programs within NASA, and that really shouldn't be the case. We ought to realize that we have competitors around the world, internationally, that are working hard to get ahead of us, and we need to return this capability to the United States and be the best in the world.
Great, thank you. And Bill, any final thoughts on that question?
Well, at the risk of being completely obscure, the thing that would be best of all right now is for a good science-based model for something called directed focused overpressure, DFO, which George will be able to explain.
Well said. Anyone who wants to know what that is, just go ahead and see Bill later. All right, this brings us to the conclusion of the panel. Thank you so much, and appreciate the panelists' time.